Hello, this is Angie Chan, and you're listening to Hard Truths, Jen Squeeze's podcast about Canada's broken generational system and how to fix it. There is major public policy action going on this week, and lucky you, we have yet another bonus episode to share. Hey, can we put on some R&B? Because it's time to turn the lights down low. Slip into something comfortable and get ready for the federal budget. Is there any way to make budgets sexy? Well, we're going to try. It's springtime. The birds are singing and I think they're looking for a mate. Our producer tells me that a peacock flashing its tail actually has a lot in common with the federal government revealing 304 silky pages of budgety beauty. Elections are like flirty looks across a busy bar, but budgets? Ooh! They are the government buying you drinks. They say, hey there, here's everything I have to offer, and here's all the cold, hard cash I'm gonna spend to prove it to you, hot stuff. Think of Jen Squeeze like your wingman or your best girlfriend at your side telling you to hold up, consider your options. As a matter of fact, let us do a background check on that budget waiting for you on the dance floor. You picking up what I'm putting down? Jen Squeeze recently hosted a live event about this federal budget's hits and misses on childcare, housing, inflation, deficits, retirement income, healthcare, climate change, and more. Ooh, there's a lot more. And as always, our founder and my co-host, Dr. Paul Kershaw, we'll explain what this budget means for generational fairness.
Okay, wonderful. Well, hi, everybody. My name's Andrea Long. I'm Generation Squeeze's Director of Research and Knowledge Mobilization, and I am joined by Dr. Paul Kershaw. We're both speaking to you today from the Fraser Valley in British Columbia on the unceded traditional territory of the Catesy people. And as we talk about the priorities and investments being made by our federal government on behalf of many Canadians who are living on unceded land, I just want to say that it's important to think deeply about our shared responsibility to reconciliation. So today we're going to talk about budgets, and budgets are important for generational fairness because they shape all of the actions governments take. If we want progress on key generational issues like housing or childcare or climate change and so on, it needs to be in the budget. So that's why at Jen Squeeze, our work to influence governments to build better budgets starts months before they're released and continues long after budget day. You also can check out jensqueeze.ca, where you'll find lots more information on our budget campaigns, including the link to our forthcoming Hard Truths video and podcast episodes exploring how budgets can influence generational fairness. So, Paul, I thought we could start off by having you tell us what you think the hard truths that we'll be discussing today.
Well, thanks so much, Andrea, and that's a great intro. Today, I'm feeling bold and ambitious enough to not feature just one hard truth, but two, along with two happy truths about the budget. So the two harder ones, the more controversial and frustrating hard truths to share are, we're going to talk about how in the most recent federal budget, there is an elephant, not just in the room, but in the budget, and it is that retirement income spending is growing rapidly, and we are not talking about it. It didn't get mentioned in the budget speech or press releases. And the second sad, hard truth is that while a lot of media attention was paid to housing investments in the most recent budget, we're not all that enthusiastic about the degree to which it will actually restore housing affordability. So we're going to talk about how it's, you know, great to see, but not enough. And that is a sad, hard truth to share. But on the happy side, we're going to talk about how childcare is really on track to never again cost another rent or mortgage-sized payment. And also talk about in a happy way that this federal budget found a decent balance between investing in the wider determinants of our well-being compared to doing what often happens, especially at a provincial level, where we tend to spend disproportionately on investing in people's medical care to treat their illness only after they fall sick, rather than prevent them from falling sick in the first place.
Great. Well, then let's jump right in. And maybe we could talk first about diving deeper into that first hard truth. So some questions about how spending is distributed by age. So you mentioned that other analyses tend to overlook where the lion's share of spending is actually going. So I'm hoping you can tell us a little more about that and why you think it's a problem.
It is the case that most listeners today are not going to see this analysis in other coverage of the budget. Certainly not what I saw in terms of like mainstream CTV or CBC coverage, unless I was on part of doing it. And I'm going to get a bit wonky in a few moments, just so that I can show you where in the budget this information actually exists. Because in a world where there's so much fake news, it's easy for people who are trusted to share misinformation. And I'm hoping I can earn people's trust tonight to show information that, while you don't see elsewhere, is absolutely baked into the budget. And the punchline is that going over the next 5 years, the thing growing the fastest, most urgently in the federal budget is spending on retirement income security. Canada has a proud tradition of investing in our aging parents and grandparents. And it could be that my mom is actually listening live right now, and who wouldn't want to make sure that his mom or dad had a financially secure, healthy retirement? And so in this 2022 federal budget, over the next 5 years, we see our government increase spending on old age security by a whopping $85 billion, which is much, much larger than, say, the $30 billion increase in medical care spending, which, by the way, half is going to go to the retiring population, the historic $27 billion in childcare. And it is, we're going to talk about how Jen Squeeze and others have continued to advocate for 10-a-day childcare. We've seen that locked into the budget over the next 5 years. It's great, but look how much smaller it is compared to what's happening with investments in retirement income security. And then investments in housing and climate change are much more modest still, at $10 and $9 billion respectively. And so, like, people are like, but I didn't hear this in the news coverage. You know, how can I believe you, Dr. Kershaw? Well, let me show you table A1.6 of the 2022 budget on page 232. And the very top line shows what's happening with elderly benefits, which is what we call old age security. And I'm going to just do what is a horrible thing to do on any podcast, a bit of math. So if you look at the $61 billion that we were spending last year on old age security, and then see how it's going to increase in the years ahead, over the next year, the government's anticipating adding it an extra $7 billion a year to grow it to $68 billion. Then in the following year, they're going to actually add almost $13 billion to grow it to nearly $74 billion. And then it's going to go up by $17 billion, and then $22 billion. And then in the fifth year, it's going to go up by a whopping $26.2 billion. And if you add that all up over 5 years, it adds $85 billion in additional spending on people that we love, our aging parents and grandparents, et cetera. But that is a large expenditure in the budget by comparison with the $30 billion we're adding to the Canada Health Transfer, the $28 billion that we're adding to childcare, et cetera. And the problem when we're not discussing this is that then when the federal government talks about the amount of deficits that it wants to run in the coming years, and it's amazing, we're not going to be in a recession, but we still have the federal government planning nearly $150 billion in deficits over the next 5 years. If we don't know what's the biggest increase in our expenditures, then we're not having a real conversation about, like, hey, are we doing what we can to make sure that we're balancing the budget in the best ways possible, or finding the right balance between investments now and paying later. And so the reality is that 60% of the deficits that we are proposing for the next 5 years can be accounted for by how we're adapting and increasing spending on old age security for our loved parents and grandparents. That alone is not a problem. Again, my mom might be listening out there. Hi, mom. Love you. But it's remarkable that no mention of this relationship between elderly benefits and the deficits was talked about in the budget speech, in the press releases, and then as a result, not in the media coverage, which curates our public discourse about, are we getting the right balance in budgets? So bringing it back to thinking about intergenerational fairness. Andrew, you mentioned, you know, intergenerational fairness exists when we foster generational reciprocity, when we plan for all ages. That's not what this budget is obviously doing. You know, the idea that you're having old age security grow so much, but it's also driving deficits, means we are asking a younger demographic and future generations to take on big bills on behalf of a group that wants important benefits, but isn't talking about how to pay for them themselves, which simultaneously means there is less left over to invest in things that matter for younger Canadians, like fighting climate change, fighting housing unaffordability, and so on, and then gets in the way of our potentially planning effectively for all ages. And this has me really concerned.
We're hearing a lot of reaction to the budget. where people are thinking that the $10 billion or so that's going into housing is actually maybe big bucks in terms of relative spending on housing in the past, but it's still a fairly small slice. So I'm wondering if we could delve into that next hard truth that you raised around housing. And you already suggested we're not investing at a scale that really will help to alleviate the housing crisis or adequately help to alleviate the housing crisis. So what else is it that we need to do? And is it really all about the size of the investment that you're talking about, the size relative to the elephant, or are there other changes that we need to make to actually get at the root of that housing crisis?
Well, given that Jen Squeeze has such a strong focus on housing affordability, we have to be appreciative that there is increased attention paid to housing in the 2022 federal budget. And the fact that it is allocating another $10 billion over the next 5 years to address affordability is important. No, it is nowhere near the level of urgency with which we are growing spending on retirement income supports for the aging population. So we can tell there's less urgency on that front, but still it's important. I think, though, what we haven't seen happen in budget 2022 is have our government actually reconcile itself to, like, what's at the root cause of this? And we've chatted in earlier episodes of this podcast that there is an addiction in Canada to high and rising home prices. We've gotten okay at talking about how rising home prices create an affordability. We're not so good at talking about how rising home prices create wealth windfalls for homeowners. And our governments aren't willing to actually have that hard conversation and ask folks like me, hey, do you need to keep getting better off while you sleep in your home, which is making those who aren't yet in the housing market worse off, driving up rising rents and so on? And also, might I be invited to contribute more going forward because I am getting these wealth windfalls? You don't see the bravery in the federal budget on that issue. And as a result, I don't think any of the things that they talk about will be up to the task to actually even stall housing prices so that earnings have a chance to catch up. Maybe later on, people will ask about the first-time homebuyer savings accounts that's out there, or, you know, the number of new co-op homes that are being promised, or the temporary moratorium on foreign buyers. Like, those are all interesting things, but are they cumulatively up to the task? I think our analysis at Jen Squeeze and many other analyses from other housing experts is the answer is no.
Well, one thing that we have recently seen this federal government recognize is that the skyrocketing housing prices we're seeing are being now called by our Deputy Prime Minister and, of course, our Finance Minister, an intergenerational injustice. And in fact, she said that that aspect of our affordability crisis is her top priority in addressing this issue. Do you agree that that's a significant development? And how does that fit into our sort of cultural change we need to address the housing crisis?
Yeah, I think it's actually very significant. Whereas I was disheartened by the federal budget per se, that our deputy prime minister is actually adopted now as the received view, what Jen Squeeze has been saying for more than any other organization out there that I know of, that housing has become the quintessential generational tension. And as I mentioned earlier, Jen Squeeze had for some years now got more attention paid to the fact that younger folks were being harmed by the housing system. But we hadn't yet had people focus increasing on attention on how the rising home prices create winners, wealth windfalls, including for people like me. And so we weren't connecting that what was harming younger folks was helping, enhancing, making more prosperous others. And the moment Minister Freeland invoked this intergenerational injustice language, she starts to put those two themes together and create more room for our country to talk about that very tension. I think that's so darn important. It hasn't resulted in changed policies yet, but policy change often requires culture change first. And you can see the work of Jen Squeeze right now being effective and influential at shaping the public discourse around housing to start to hone in on this generational tension.
Yes, that's a great segue opportunity to maybe switch gears a little to what you called at the beginning, the happy truths, because I think another place where we're seeing some real positive movement, of course, is around childcare. And Generation Squeeze has been a real leading voice for the last decade on making life more affordable for younger Canadians, including by asking governments to make sure childcare isn't like another rent or mortgage-sized payment. So now that we're on the road to that goal with federal budget commitments to $10 a day childcare, it's exciting to be able to talk about a policy victory for generational fairness rather than feeling like we're always pointing to the gaps. So I wonder if you could maybe share some thoughts on how we've got to this point and if there are things that still remain to be done to really make an effective affordable childcare system, what are those things?
Well, I'm glad we are focusing on a happy truth because the way we set up the podcast around hard truths, we do risk being a bit of a downer. So we're always trying to end in hope. And people have heard in previous episodes how I talk about sort of the love between generations is something we can draw on. And you can kind of see that love manifest itself finally in the world of politics, where it was back in 1970 when the Royal Commission on the Status of Women first proposed a national childcare program. And it took us over 50 years to finally achieve that. And there were many, many actors who've come before and paved the way for us to finally achieve this really dramatic historic investment in childcare that we see now increasingly locked into the federal budget. And I do want to take hope from the fact that part of that work was around framing. And when the federal government announced its investment in a national child care program, let there be no mistake, it wasn't a coincidence that they latched onto that $10 a day label. That was good branding to get people's heads around, oh, we can make child care less expensive. And that matters as our society is losing control over housing prices, because we see people struggling with actual rent and actual mortgages. We can't let childcare be a second rent size payment or a second mortgage payment. And that was exactly the language that we saw used to justify the large investments in childcare in this year and the previous year's federal budget. And so it's exciting to see that, both because we can be excited by our group and groups like the $10 a day childcare movement in BC having had this now national influence on public dialogue, but it also, I hope, gives hope to those so vexed and frustrated by the housing situation that the cultural framing is indeed part of the solution making. And so going back to the reality now that the Deputy Prime Minister has laudably, bravely, nobly acknowledge that spiraling housing prices are an intergenerational injustice, I think that becomes a precursor to the policy change, just in the way that governments starting to get their heads around $10 a day childcare and childcare not being another rent size payment was part of the cultural, the discourse change required to achieve actual budget change. So I'm excited about that. And let's definitely take our hats off and applaud the federal government for doing something we hadn't seen previous federal governments do, nor doing something that other provincial governments could have stepped up to do and hadn't yet done. But there does remain work. In our $10 a day recommendation at Jen Squeeze, $10 was supposed to be the maximum fee. And if you read the fine print, the federal government is saying that, well, it will be the average fee. So some households are likely still to incur more. I think we really need to double our efforts to make sure that we cap childcare fees at no more than $10 a day. And our advocacy will continue to pursue that in the months and years ahead with the federal and provincial governments.
Yeah, thanks. That is important in terms of balancing out other costs that families with young kids are facing. A second happy truth that you mentioned off the top was following a similar theme about how we balance our investments. So in this case, it was about balancing our investments in medical care with our investments that we're making in the wider factors that shape our health. So things like the air we breathe, the food we eat, where we live, whether we are managed to earn enough to buy the things that we need, where we work, and so on. So I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about how you see this budget affirming the importance of investing and preserving medical care when we're sick, but also investing in preserving the social conditions that help to keep us healthy.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's so important coming out of the pandemic, because we start to ask ourselves, like, what does promoting well-being entail? And we have a tendency in Canada to be so proud of our medical care system. In fact, we often determine that we're different from our neighbors to the south because we have publicly funded medical care and they don't. So it's part of our national identity. But as a result, we then tend to have this sort of cultural predilection that more medical care must always be better. But the data show otherwise. The data show that we're more likely to improve our population's health and well-being and longevity the more we invest in social issues, social programs, by comparison with medical care. And so it's kind of akin to, you know, we all want a good mechanic when our car breaks down, just like we want a good doctor when we're sick. But what we want even more is actually to have our car stay out of the repair shop, have us stay out of the doctor's office. And we can do that by investing in social conditions that make and keep us healthy. And our medical care system was never supposed to go it alone. It was always supposed to be part of a system supporting Canadians with decent earnings and homes and education and a sustainable planet. And I think it's exciting to see that we specifically were looking for the Canada social transfer to grow with more urgency than the Canada health transfer. Getting a bit wonkish right now, but the point was, are we growing social transfers to provinces more rapidly than the illness treatment, the medical transfer? And it's harder to actually track that these days because this federal government's adding a bunch of new social expenditures. But when you add in the housing and you add in the childcare to the Canada social transfer, I think it's fair to say the federal government's actually living up to that hope and expectation. And so good on them for recognizing that health doesn't start with medical care. It starts where we're born, grow, live, work, and age, and finding the right balance in investing those conditions and maintaining a public healthcare system is critical.
Yeah, there's so much one could say on this theme alone, especially as we're emerging from the pandemic and thinking about building back better. And what does that mean beyond sort of reinvigorating and dealing with wait lists in our medical system? There are other ways and other investments that are important to building back better as well.
Can I just say on that point, I mean, it's a theme we're going to be talking more and more about in the months ahead, including on this podcast, including more generally at Gen Squeeze. And it's a theme that's, you know, the light is being shone on in no small part because of the recent agreement between the federal NDP and the federal Liberals, where the NDP were pushing, you know, important things like pharmacare and dental care. And we're wanting to add new things into that space. Laudable goal, but we've got to be careful to not have those things crowd out the investments in housing and fighting climate change and poverty reduction and whatnot. So Gen Squeeze is going to be really honed in on that issue in the months ahead.
Yeah, really exciting. That's a critical conversation for Canada in the coming years. But I did just want to touch on one other quick thing, which was climate change commitments. So climate change, of course, is another huge intergenerational issue in terms of the massive climate debts that we're leaving to younger and future generations to deal with, and the cost of those debts, both personally and in terms of our infrastructure. So I did just want to note that, of course, the budget reaffirmed the around $9 billion in climate investments. So the government has backed up the recently released 2030 emissions reduction plan, which was great to see. The plan is sort of generally being viewed as fairly comprehensive and ambitious, which is really exciting for Canada. But also commentators are noting that its success really depends on making the specific policies we need to turn those commitments and statements of principle into reality. So I'm curious how you think we can ensure that governments can be held accountable to actually implement this kind of follow-up that we need so urgently.
That's a great question. One of the recommendations that we put forward to the federal government in advance of the budget is that they should, it would cost very little, but resource an expansion of the mandate for our national net zero advisory board. So maybe many of the listeners will know that recently the federal government did create this net zero advisory board, which is a really important group leading the definition about emissions reduction targets and so on. But what it hasn't done is kind of give it like a watchdog-like accountability mechanism. It hasn't allowed that net zero advisory board to have some authority to point out and hold accountable the federal government if and when we don't meet our targets en route to achieving net zero. So we have this net zero legislation, and it doesn't have a lot of transparency right now in how we're modeling our emissions projections. And it isn't yet giving any clear implications for what happens if and when we fail to meet targets. And we need to somewhat anticipate that we might, because I don't think our country has ever met a nationally established target. So at this moment, we know that other jurisdictions have an independent body provide that nonpartisan, evidence-based advice and monitoring. And empowering our net zero advisory board seems like an obvious opportunity for a group to play that role, to give us better accountability for meeting our climate goals. And unfortunately, I don't see that in this federal budget document at this moment. I think that's a real missed opportunity. And then after the budget, I think we saw a key example about why it's a missed opportunity.
And I assume you're referring to the new approval that was given to the Newfoundland oil development?
Yeah, we did see just days after the federal government had our 2022 budget, it put out what many did herald as an ambitious emissions reduction plan between now and 2030. We then had this interesting moment where we approved a brand new oil project in Newfoundland. In the very week when the UN Secretary General said that investing in new fossil fuel infrastructure is moral and economic madness right now. And I wonder if we had a net zero advisory body with more chops as watchdogs to hold our governments to account, whether or not, you know, we would be going down this route in quite the same way that we currently are. And I find myself really thinking about that. And I guess, you know, coming back to the beginning of our conversation where we talked about $150 billion in deficits over the next 5 years at the federal level. And I was like, well, if a huge amount of that was put into fighting climate change, you might have me say, yeah, I get that kind of expenditure right now and why we might not be paying all the bills right away. But that's not what we're incurring the deficits for right now. We've seen that the elephant in the budget is actually the growth in the spending on old age security. Again, important stuff for the aging parents and grandparents we love, but not the corresponding fight of what's really an existential threat, climate change.
Yeah, thanks for that, Paul. So I think maybe it would be a good time now to talk about some of the questions that we've received from folks participating today. I want to start with one that I think really nicely ties back to the conversation about the balance between investing in medical care and in the social conditions that help promote health. In your view, is the federal government investing enough in public health and responding to the ongoing COVID pandemic? And they're specifically wondering, do you think we're preparing adequately for new waves? And I would maybe even add new pandemics or the next pandemic, as well as sort of the long-term impacts of COVID.
What a great question. And I feel like I'm put on the spot because some may know that I'm a professor in the School of Population and Public Health at UBC. And so my professional field has a stake at saying we need more for public health. And we do. I think like the relative balance of investment in public health relative to other parts of the medical care system hasn't been quite, you know, adequately reached yet. But I will say, ultimately, I hope that public health champions the idea that we need to grow more urgently the investments in poverty reduction, in housing, in childcare, in fighting climate change, in fighting racism, et cetera, because those are the wider determinants of our well-being. And so ultimately, our discipline knows that we grow the population's health and well-being. We increase life expectancy. We reduce avoidable sickness and death when we grow spending on those social determinants more urgently than medical care. And public health falls into the medical care budget. So we need people in public health to actually champion our institutional goal, which is better health for the population, in no small part by actually setting aside our institutional interests, more money for our medical care system, and instead championing that money going even more urgently to things like poverty reduction, childcare, housing, climate change, and so on. Great question, though. Hope I didn't ruffle the feathers of too many of my public health colleagues.
I think that all those things are important public health spending. I think all those excellent folks who work in the field of social determinants of health and looking at the distribution of health impacts, which I think we saw really clearly over the pandemic, definitely skewed towards, you know, neighborhoods that tended to have lower incomes and more precarious employment, really underscore that part of mitigating the effects of future waves of COVID or future health crises is actually ensuring that people are living in adequate social conditions. So I want to move on to another question, which goes back to the first part of your comments today and why we're seeing that there's so little formal attention given to the large investments we're making in things like seniors' income security. So the person is asking, like, what do you think the reason is for that? You know, why would the government not want to sort of take credit for its efforts to protect and promote the income security of seniors and our legacy of reducing poverty for that age group?
Yeah, for me, that is like the multi-billion dollar question. And I wish I had a fully worked out answer because then I would act on it and try and change it by tomorrow. I think there are a few factors. In earlier episodes of this podcast, we've talked about how there is a cultural myth to imagine that the most economically vulnerable citizens in Canada tend to be older. And we've shown that, you know, older Canadians actually have the lowest rates of poverty and the highest rates of wealth. So that myth is outdated. But I think it does still seep into the culture of budgeting and doesn't encourage our policymakers to be scrutinizing that reality. I think that's one part of it. I think a second part, what's driving the growth in federal spending on retirees right now isn't really a decision that Prime Minister Trudeau and his government made this year or even since coming into power, is actually reflecting decisions we made decades ago by setting up the system of old age security and not necessarily asking our hardworking parents and grandparents during their working lives, who definitely pay taxes throughout their lives, but actually, as it turned out, we didn't design the old age security system in a way that asked them to pay enough in advance in taxes for their old age security benefits that they would want to draw down later. Governments aren't quite sure how do they have that conversation now with Canadians. And I do believe that institutional reality is one of the primary barriers. So when I'm having meetings with Finance Canada or Treasury Canada, or going to the Prime Minister's office, I'm pleading with them to say, don't just report on what's, you know, your deficit, go and investigate what's the primary thing driving it. You have your tables that actually highlight it, and then help Canadians have that conversation. But the institution struggles to pull that off. And Jen Squeeze has more work to do, and with the audience listening right now, hopefully helping us to create additional pressure for governments to honestly and with due care and responsibility talk about this elephant in the budget.
Yeah, and of course, the flip side of that is Jen Squeeze has been making the point over many years that governments tend to spend far less to support younger people than they do for older ages. That trend persists despite the growing time, money, service, climate squeezes that those populations are facing. So, sorry, I'm inserting my own follow-up question here. There's the actual shift in spending we may want to achieve, going back to your comments about, are we adapting urgently enough for the needs facing younger and future generations? But then there's the mechanics of it as well. So how do you think we actually get the clearer reporting by age that is not adequately reflected in the budget?
Well, I think one way we might achieve that is we need ministerial responsibility. And so listeners may know that there is in Canada a minister for seniors. There is no corresponding minister for intergenerational fairness. And I guess to some degree, we might have a minister responsible for younger people, younger generations, as it's part of our diversity and inclusion mandate. But I think at this stage, given that we have our Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, saying that the spiraling housing prices are an intergenerational injustice and that this is now her top domestic concern, that would give us reason to have either a minister or a deputy minister responsible for this issue. And that, I think, would allow us to make real headway. Because it is the case that Jen Squeeze did actually in 2019 get the federal government to do something historic, for the first time ever, try and report on the age trends in its budget. But it was a terrible example of careful what you wish for, because they did it very, very badly. And the analysis they did is inaccurate and not defensible. So we need to help them get better on that front. And I think that the ministerial or deputy ministerial accountability could be really helpful. Hey, I see a question coming up that's bringing us back to the housing space. Somebody noting that our Bank of Canada has recently increased interest rates and asking, like, do we think that might have an influence on housing prices? I actually think, whereas the budget federally is not likely to have the outcome of restoring affordability for all, that the rise in interest rates may be that extra useful tool in our quest to achieve affordability. I think we might be able to hope that the rise in interest rates, it started now and it's going to continue over the year and into next year, I imagine too, that will actually create a bit of a dampening pressure on rising prices. That'll be good for the housing system, you know, pushing home prices to finally stall, give up that relentless increase, maybe even go down. But of course, there will be some individuals who will be frustrated by that, because we know that in particular, many younger Canadians have been counting on lower interest rates. If they're dreaming of moving from renting and facing rising rents as property values go up, and they're like, I want to get out of that rental crunch and, you know, not have to deal with landlords, but I'm going to do that by using these low interest rates to borrow more money than I might otherwise do. And by borrowing more, I'll hack this dysfunctional system and I'll get myself into more secure housing. And as interest rates go up, it's harder than to borrow more. And people are like, that doesn't work for me. And so there's this tension between what's going to be good for the system, stalling home prices, hopefully for years, so that earnings have a genuine chance to catch up, versus individuals feeling like, I was counting on those low interest rates to try and break into this dysfunctional system. And this is, I guess, a different kind of hard truth to have with like core Gen Squeeze constituency, which tends younger to say, we need that group to be supportive of the ultimate systems change and to recognize that, well, the costs of borrowing are likely to go up now as interest rates rise. Not likely, they will go up as interest rates rise. But a $50,000 to $100,000 a year increase in housing prices fueled by low interest rates creates many more affordability challenges by comparison with the increase in rising interest rates. And so keeping our eye on the prize of like, our goal just has to be for these damn home prices to not continue to rise. And interest rate changes are likely a component of that.
Continuing on with that theme, there's a couple other questions that touch on some of the specifics that were included in the budget around housing. And the questions specifically are asking about the tax-free savings piece and also some of the investments that are assisting municipalities to accelerate their housing development.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm actually heartened to hear that the federal government actually allocated $500 million for cooperative housing. We haven't had a set of funds specifically to grow deeply affordable cooperative housing in the future. Now, the National Cooperative Organization, the Canada Cooperative Housing Federation, says we actually need more like $15 billion to create, I think it's 90,000 new cooperative housing units. So the $500 million is clearly an incremental start, and we're going to need much more. But I'm hopeful that the focus on cooperative housing will be something we see grow in the budgets in the future. The $4 billion, and I'm just forgetting the term, I think it was Accelerator Fund.
Mm-hmm.
Accelerator Fund. Thanks for helping me out. I was having a brain cramp there. This is in line with something Jen Squeeze has been asking for years. And people are like, what's an accelerator fund? Well, we know at the municipal level that local politicians are especially subject to the political risks of NIMBYism. So when people in low-density neighborhoods, single detached house neighborhoods, don't want to add rental or others missing middle density, people will go to city hall meetings and say, we don't want this. But what we've been asking is for provincial and federal governments to try and provide some municipal elected officials some political cover. And that's what this accelerator fund does. It says to cities, hey, you're going to get a bigger share of federal transfers for housing if and only if you more urgently add density in line with the city plans that you've been creating. That's right. You think about where you add density, but the more urgently you add density, the more of the federal transfer you're going to get, which then allows the municipal politician to say to the NIMBY, you know what? If our community is going to get the biggest share of housing transfer from Ottawa, we need to more aggressively add density, including in your neighborhood. So I like that it's aiming to give that political cover and disrupt the local political dynamics that can impede adding the supply and especially the rental supply that we desperately need. And then I wonder what people think about the first time home buyer's savings account, where it's like an RRSP and a tax-free saving account all in one. It allows people to save this $40,000 over 5 years, if I'm recalling the details correctly. And I think that in many respects, an orientation to helping, in particular, younger demographic try and deal with the collateral damage of rising housing prices, I think that's an appropriate thing for us to do as a society. Is it going to be enough? The reality is unlikely, especially if we don't stall home prices. Like, average home prices went up last year by like about $100,000. So this tax-free saving account allows you to save 40 over 5 years. If we're not slowing home prices down, we're just going to have those first-time buyers fall further behind, no matter how much this particular tax measure might help. So those would be a few of my observations. I think one last one I'll highlight because it's a pet provocative project of Jen Squeeze. And that is that in the 2022 federal budget, there was an entire chapter devoted to looking at tax fairness issues, looking at tax shelters, and thinking about how to ask the wealthy to pay their fair share. An entire chapter in budget 2022 was devoted to closing those kinds of tax loopholes. And yet, ironically, there is no mention whatsoever in that chapter of the homeownership tax shelter, which incentivizes homeowners to welcome and celebrate rising home prices. And some may not have heard me talk about the homeownership tax shelter before, so let me just do the Coles Note version. Anyone who went to paid work today is going to have 100% of their labor earnings subject to tax. If they take some of those after-tax earnings and invest in the stock market, 50% of any return on investment will be subject to tax. But if you're a homeowner like me and enjoy wealth windfalls like I have, barely any of those are going to be subject to tax. And so when we shelter some assets from taxation, we encourage Canadians to say, that's the kind of asset I should pursue as an investment strategy. And so in other words, our tax policy encourages Canadians to not only treat housing as a place to call home, but as a good investment strategy, as a way to get rich. And that then reinforces our cultural addiction to high and rising home prices. And Jen Squeeze isn't bold enough to say we should get rid of the principal residence capital gains exemption. But we do think that there's lots of room to be nibbling around the edges of this homeownership tax shelter and asking the Canadians who own the most valuable 10% of homes to contribute slightly more in taxation to address the affordability crisis that has locked so many younger people out and renters and newcomers of any age out of the housing market. But I think that just once again represents how there remains a leeriness, an unwillingness to tackle some of the root cultural problems and the root tensions in our housing system that sustain high and rising home prices.
Yeah, that's a great answer, Paul. Thanks for touching on the tax piece, which I know has definitely earned Generation Squeeze some pushback, let's just say, some of which has been less pleasant and some of which has been more constructive.
It's true. We're likely to get more emails with F off and die every time we talk about that. But we're going to soldier on because this is actually a part of the culture change that needs to happen.
So moving on to another question, another person is asking what you think about the track record of this government when it comes to making promises and budgets, but then not delivering them with actual spending. And then related to that, the second part is, are there parts of this budget that you think are more aspirational and perhaps a bit less practical?
Oh, great question. And you know, I want to be careful about characterizing an entire track record of a government, either negatively or positively, I guess in no small part because, well, Jen Squeeze is a critic of a range of municipal, provincial, and federal policies. We also have to be in the business of instilling hope and confidence in our citizenry, and especially a younger demographic that often checks out of the world of politics, to come to recognize that it's via the world of politics that we can change this dysfunctional generational system, just in the same way it's that via politics, we have to change systemic racism and systemic sexism and systemic colonialism. And so I want to find the right balance here and say, you know, this is a federal government that delivered on a childcare promise in a way that we hadn't seen in 50 years. That's no small thing. And so I want us to think that the track record isn't entirely about promising and not delivering. And heck, this is a federal government that came up with a national housing strategy. Is it up to the task? No, but we didn't have one for decades. And so, you know, we got to give credit on that front. And then groups like Jen Squeeze are to try and instill faith in the world of politics and say, we need to use that faith to demand more. I have heard some people talk about this 2022 budget as being aspirational, in particular in terms of some of the assumptions about how much the economy and how fast the economy is going to continue to grow going down the road, which then means that our debt to GDP ratio, it may not be as worrisome as some might think. Or conversely, if they're not right about those aspirations, then the debt to GDP ratio is more worrisome than to some degree the government is suggesting it is. And I just want to talk about maybe that theme, because if we're a country that's running about $150 billion in deficits over the next 5 years, and we're not in a recession, and we're not using those deficits to go and disproportionately invest in green, affordable housing infrastructure to solve both the housing challenge and the climate challenge, if that's not what's that infrastructure is not really driving our debt, then we've risked becoming a Canadian culture and population which says, we want more benefits, but please, world of politics, don't ask us to have the hard question about how we're going to pay for it. We'd like our cake, we want to eat it too, but we don't want to pay for the baking of it. And I'm not sure when Canadians risked tolerating that, but I hearken back to the 2021 election, and not a single political party at the federal level promised to balance budgets in the next term of government. So that's not a partisan statement. That's just describing now the state of Canadian politics. And I think there's something then aspirational that underscores what's driving that hope that, oh, our debt to GDP ratio is just going to be fine. And we're not having a harder conversation about why can't we ask Canadians to pay now for what they want to use, especially here, hard truth to the older generations in our lives, for that old age security driving so much of the deficit spending. Why can't we ask them as a generational cohort to say, let's take responsibility to make sure we pay for this so that we don't leave large bills for our kids and grandchildren to take on, especially since the data show in a not a very aspirational way, not a very positive way, not a very hopeful way. Like, their earnings have stagnated and gone down after inflation. They're facing these crazy housing prices. They're facing higher student debt levels, and going to post-secondary doesn't land us jobs that pay generous pensions any longer or extended health coverage. And then we face these risks of climate change. I worry that we are too aspirational about the debt to GDP ratio and not aspirational enough about fighting the things that are leaving a less than proud legacy for younger Canadians and future generations. Uh-oh, I'm sorry. That was a long answer and took us almost to the end.
Yeah, I think we'll have to probably close it down there. Although in the spirit of, as you said earlier, always wanted to end on a hopeful note, I will just say, if you want to take 30 seconds to say anything about how we can make change, how people can contribute, why don't you add that?
Yeah, well, one thing we're trying to do better this year at Gen Squeeze is that we focus a lot on budgets. It's a part of our theory of change. It's the most important policy document that a government will put out. And we want to be in the business of influencing it to make that budget work for all generations. But budgets aren't just made a couple of days before they're publicized. Budgets are made literally months and months and months in advance. And so while we're sharing tonight the commentary about the federal 2022 budget, in many respects, it's launching our campaign to make the 2023 budget all the better. And so people have heard what we think is strong about the budget, and we're going to continue to champion that and see that it gets locked in future years. And you've heard our concerns about what is weak in this budget. And that's where we're going to be focusing our attention, literally starting tomorrow, in our engagement with decision makers directly and in our engagement with listeners of the podcast and with our constituency and Gen Squeeze more generally to say, hey, help us keep these issues alive in the public discourse and show that we need to have constructive frustration about how housing and still childcare and climate change are not being addressed rapidly enough, and then use that to create the political cover needed for our politicians to bravely legislate a better budget next time around. And I guess I would alert people to the fact that Ontario is about to have its budget, which is then going to launch into the Ontario election. And Gen Squeeze will bring our voter guide analysis to the Ontario election. So if people are looking for nonpartisan, evidence-based assessments of what's going on in the various platforms, then stay tuned for Gen Squeeze and check out our voter's guide, in addition to listening to future episodes of our Hard Truths podcast.
We hope you enjoyed our bonus budget episode. To learn more about Gen Squeeze's budget analysis, check out gensqueeze.ca. Have questions? Reach out to us on social media or email info@gensqueeze.ca. Don't forget to look up Gen Squeeze on YouTube and check out our latest video. Now that you know how sexy budgets can be, we hope you'll join us for our next regular Hard Truths episode, and we'll dig deeper into why it's so important that government budgets work for all generations. Thanks for listening.